This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note, the views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Good evening. My dream is to one day get the chance to introduce Josh, get him back for what he does. That's my dream. I hope we can work that out the next time he's lecturing. I'll try and give him a great intro. Okay, I can get him. Yeah, yes. Right. We're talking about the future of work, part two today. But before I jump into my remarks, I just want to poll the audience. So we're going to have a discussion afterwards, but I'm going to cheat a little bit and get a discussion going beforehand. All right, so I'm probably going to ask three or four questions, no pressure to answer, but I'll probably call on you anyways. So the first question on the future of work, right? So would you describe yourself, or are you anxious or concerned or neither about the future of work? Like, what's your general feeling? Are you anxious, concerned, none of the above, haven't thought about it? What do you think? Go for it.
It seems to be hard for even people who have talent and ability to get a decent job now.
Yeah, okay.
I just worry about robots taking over more and more.
Yeah.
I mean, recently we used to have people that picked up our recycling, but now they don't work there anymore. There's a machine that picks up our recycling.
Oh, yeah, okay.
What happened to them?
Yeah.
I think your field of work determines the response to that question. Like, if it's a job that actually requires humans to do it, then you're not too concerned. But if you can replace, then you're more concerned than people would be.
That's the next question. Hold that thought. She said that she thinks it depends on the field that you're in, how you respond to that question. All right, so we'll go to the next question then. Okay, no, Ben, you had something. Go over it.
I was anxious. Yes.
Yeah, okay. All right. So the next question was, what current industry do you work in, and is your industry safe from automation? Right. Or needing or not needing a human? What do you think? But you guys are safe. You guys definitely need humans. Okay. All right.
I work in development in the nonprofit sector, and a lot of people think that because it's a relationship-based field, that it is safe from automation and artificial intelligence. But in reality, you could probably automate that. You know, with mass marketing and automated email series, algorithms to skim different nonprofit
scam
websites. To cover the information on different nonprofits' websites, and then an individual could easily just make an informed decision as to where they would like to invest in, you know, community revitalization. Mm. So.
Okay.
Well, I'm 82, but I remember back probably when I was maybe 16, I don't remember the exact year, people were concerned about automation, even then, the taking over jobs that people normally would do.
Yeah.
Even then.
Now, having lived between 16 and now, what's your perspective? Were your fears realized?
I still worry about that. I don't know as much about it probably as people have spoken before me, but I worry some of it. I mean, we couldn't buy a ticket at the station because you have to go to some machine.
Not
even one person could be employed during rush hour.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Anyone else? Is your industry safe? Yeah?
So I'm a software engineer, so my industry kind of pushes automation.
It's all your fault.
I'm the bad guy.
Okay. So you think you guys are safe? You think you guys are safe? You'll be around for a little bit?
I mean, there is some thought about...
Softwaring yourself out of software?
Yeah.
Okay.
Potentially, you know, AI to write new code.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Anyone else? I guess I'll answer. So by day, I'm a mechanical engineer, and we design parts. Well, I used to design parts for airplane engines, but we have a whole wing of engineering that's looking at essentially how to automate certain parts of our job and how to provide the right tools to supposedly make our jobs go better or be easier. Because, you know, for example, you know, we used to like draft, not me, because, you know, drafting and like actually drawing things on pieces of paper was gone before I came into the field. So, you know, then you kind of have a weird balance between all the young guns that don't know too much, but we can use that computer to draft you a 3D model, right? So it's kind of like you need the sages to sit there and, well, you probably shouldn't do it like that because of this. So it's kind of an interesting hybrid. But I can definitely see certain areas of the job being obsolete and no longer necessary. Like, for example, when I first started working, we designed something that we called actuation systems. So essentially what that was supposed to do, in an airplane engine, and you have the fan in the front of it, and then right after the fan, you have a compressor, right? So in the compressor, airplane engines are actually really simple technology. They just bring a lot of air in, then they squeeze it down, then they light it on fire, and then it runs off of that. That's really all it is. So when you bring the air in, right, sometimes there's like particles that get inside the air, right? It's like dirt and ice sometimes, depending on how high you fly. And so the system that I was designing would open and close to let ice and hail and things out of there. But you have to like program it depending on where it is in the flight cycle. But all of those things could essentially be automated if you get the right information from the flight cycle, you kind of know the right architecture of the engines, and, you know, engine design changes some, but it hasn't changed drastically in a number of years. So I can imagine, you know, that you don't really necessarily need a human being that you got to pay healthcare to and that might come to work late, although I never did. I was always on time. That's not funny. And, you know, takes 2 weeks vacations, sometimes three, as you move on up. So I can see the calculus being done, right? Okay, two more questions. So, do you think that the post-work, what we mean by post-work is no more work, society, really a possibility, right? How many say, yes, I think it's a possibility?
Complete.
Complete. Post work, meaning no more work for anybody.
Like, not even chores.
Oh. Well, they're actually designing robots to clean houses. They are. They actually are.
Because you got to eat, though. So
okay,
like,
so okay. How about.
I'm just trying to understand.
Okay, how about no more work for money? Anybody? Anybody?
No more work for who?
For money. Now it's like, you know, you don't go and trade your skills on the labor market, right? So no more jobs, I guess. We'll okay. So is everybody saying no? That's not a possibility whatsoever. How many say no? This one is. All right. Okay. Interesting. All right. Okay. Now this is the last question now. So the last question is, if you personally won the lottery, and the lottery drawing was $1 billion, right? Would you, A, still work at your current job, right? That's A. Or B, go find another job. Or C, stop working altogether, right? C? Okay. How many for C? How many for C? All right. Okay. How many for A? How many for A? You would still work at your current job. Okay? You would still work. Okay. And then how many for B? You would go find another job. All right, you go find another job.
Okay. I want to be able to keep my current job and have all of my side hustles.
Say it again.
I would like to keep my current job and also all of my side hustles too.
Okay. Okay. So let me hear why. Anybody, like, why would you go ahead?
I enjoy working with kids. It's what I do. I feel like.
Are you sure about that?
Yes.
If you had $1 billion in the bank, you would go and get yelled at and spit on.
For the sake of helping their health, yes.
Okay, if you say so. So you're a saint. Okay, anyone else? Let's hear why. Yeah?
I teach high school history and I love it.
Oh,
I
Lord.
I go part time.
Oh, just Lord.
So I wouldn't have to grade so many papers.
Yeah, okay.
But
you just love teaching history.
I do.
Wow.
Awesome.
Okay.
Yes.
Wow. You must have a great class. You know, okay. Glad you didn't teach me because it would have been a different story. So that Abba guy? I'm joking. Anyone else? So then how many said that they would stop working altogether? Okay. Only one. Okay. So why so?
I don't like to get up in the morning.
Okay. It's honest.
I guess I've never really.
Everyone that laughs doesn't like to get up in the morning either. They're all thinking about Monday at 6:30 when the alarm goes off.
Right.
They deep down inside it's there. We know.
But Russell, you should say
I don't have a job.
Many years,
100-hour
week.
Yeah.
You're going out for more. I think you should say that.
Okay. Okay. Anyone else? Any other thoughts on the?
Yep. Well, I probably would not, unless it was just a part-time voluntary job. Otherwise, they wouldn't do a job as such. But I think that, at least I would hope that I would. To try to do things which are constructive and perhaps help people or communicate or write people, things like that, or other things that might be constructive and help.
Okay.
Without having an automatic 9 to 5, 5 or 6 days.
Yeah, it's kind of constrictive. I agree. Yeah. Although I have one. Yeah?
I think I would employ a few people to help me figure out what to do with the money so it wouldn't ruin my life.
Basically,
use the money.
Yeah.
Which would be a major, major, major
job.
I'd have to look long and hard for the right people to.
Well, if you won $1 million.
I would have to do it because
I would not do well with the money.
Okay.
That's a lot of trust.
Yeah. If you won $1 million or $1 billion.
Billion.
Sorry.
It was a
If you won $1 billion, this is my roommate here, Roderick. He works in finance. He can help you out. You know, so exchange contacts. I think we'll sign him up for that. Yeah. Just in case it ever happens, right? Okay. All right. Anything else? All right. So, work, as we all know, is a central part of our human existence. In America, it's almost, I would call it our unofficial religion, to work and to be industrious. I even call it the sanctity and the preeminence of work lie at the heart of our country's economy, our politics, and our social interactions, right? We're actually the worker bees of the Western world, right? So between 1950 and 2012, annual hours worked fell by 40% in Germany and the Netherlands. But in the United States of America, it only fell by 10%. And then actually amongst college-educated Americans, they're actually working more now than they did 30 years ago. All right, so, and we all know that technological change has a fundamental part about how we work, right? It's actually intimately tied into economic growth for centuries. At one point, we were mainly an agricultural society. Then we had the Industrial Revolution, and we kind of moved more to manufacturing. And now, in the second machine age, we are, I would say, mainly service-driven workers, right? As one of my favorite quotes from Neil Postman, technology giveth and technology taketh away. And so what will the future hold? for work? Will workers become obsolete? Will machines and robots take all of our jobs? And how will we distribute wealth and goods? A recent McKinsey study said that 45% of workers' current tasks could be automated. That's actually down 5% from a 2013 Oxford study that estimated 50% of workers' current tasks could be automated. And the World Bank...
What sort of time? Was there a time figure put on that?
That was the near future for McKinsey.
Oh, near future.
Yeah. That's what they said. But the World Bank estimates that 57% of jobs within the next 20 years are on the line. Right? And so in part one, we broadly laid out the trends that are affecting and shaping the future of work. We talked about urbanization. Essentially, many people across the globe are clustering and moving into cities because that's where a lot of the opportunities tend to be. We talked about demography. We talked about just in the Western world, how the Western world is aging while the emerging world is very young. We talked about globalization, how there was a new consuming class that's emerging, people with enough disposable income to buy goods. And then we talked about as well the wage stagnation or hollowing out of the middle class and how all those factors are affecting the future of work. So tonight we're going to focus on how work is being affected by growing inequality, technology advances, specifically AI, machine learning, and deep learning. And then we're going to end with what specific tools the Christian faith provides us to navigate the paradox and challenges of work. All right, so first, inequality, or growing inequality. Growing inequality has been a national and global conversation point for, I would say, maybe about the past 10 years. And if you can't earn a livable wage, why work? As technology races ahead, can humans keep up fast enough to have the right skills to be employable in the market? At the same time, the rich economies are actually producing a lot of money, right? But it's being concentrated, you know, at the top, right? So we saw this in the Occupy Wall Street movements. We saw this even be debated or talked about in the recent elections where with, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, he's blaming the banks and, you know, the rich people, and then Trump was blaming globalization, right? And people also said that this was one of the drivers within Brexit. So we just saw how this growing inequality or the middle class stagnating, wages stagnating, people just kind of take that and they can put their different kind of spin on it, right? Many economists write about this. I think probably one of the most notable ones is Thomas Piketty. He wrote a book called Capital in the 21st Century. He's a French economist, and he essentially argued that wealth is growing faster than the economic output, right? Or put another way, wages have become decoupled from productivity. So although, you know, we're creating a lot more money, it's just being concentrated at the top. That was his kind of argument. People debate what the competing factors are, but no one is really debating that this is actually happening, right? So some people blame globalization. Some people blame technology. They argue about, you know, what share is driving what. The book, The Second Machine Age, by two MIT professors, Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, what they say, they explain it as they think it's being mainly driven by technology, and because the way that technology comes in and affects the economy currently is that it affects the bounty and the spread. Essentially, it's creating winner-take-all markets, and it's creating a lot of money, but it's just not trickling down. I think last time I used the example of Kodak versus Instagram, where Kodak was a staple for 135 years. They were employing a lot of people, but Instagram came in 2 years and put them out of business with probably, you know, less than 75% of the workforce. You also can use the example of TurboTax. There was, you know, being a tax preparer was, you know, a very, you know, I would say, you know, it's a okay paying job, and, you know, you prepare people's taxes, but then TurboTax comes and, you know, it makes a couple people very, very rich because they just can codify how to put your taxes together, and then they can mass distribute it, everybody buys it, and then it puts a lot of people out of work. So it's the bounty and the spread. And then the challenges really become as the capabilities of computing continue to increase and the price of computing gets cheaper, this cycle that we see of growing inequality will continue. Right? So then the question becomes, how will human beings become compensated for their labor and how will money get distributed as inequality is growing? Right, so that's kind of happening on the with jobs. And then you have another professor, Robert Putnam, at Harvard, where he wrote a book, Are Kids the American Dream in Crisis, where he's arguing that essentially the America is becoming more unequal based off of education. And he uses this by collecting data and just going through different neighborhoods and collecting people's stories. So he starts in his hometown of Ohio, where he's saying, well, in his time, he looks at how he did and the other people. And so he was saying this kind of America as this land of opportunity where there's, if you have equal access, then everyone can come up and kind of grow together. And he's saying, well, now, 50 years later, what he argues is that the biggest factor on how you do in life is actually if your parents went to college or not, right? And so, and so he's arguing that now growing socially, we have a growing isolation problem. So, you know, based on your education, that's going to tell how you do, and then especially how your children do. And so he just kind of shows you about the lives of those who, you know, only have a high school education or less versus those who go to college. And so he just makes the argument, I want to say from a different angle, of the growing inequality. And he also argues that now in that growing class of, you know, poverty, the biggest problem is isolation and trust. They don't, because from a very early young age, the people that you're supposed to trust, they fail you, society fails you, the schools are failing you, and there's just that's what happens. So then there's a clear widening gap between education as well. There's an article on The Atlantic came out maybe late August, and the title was The Myth of American Universities as Inequality Fighters. Right, and he discussed a new paper by five economists that argued America's top universities are largely closed to the poor and they're merely helping well-off students remain well-off. That was kind of the argument of the that economic paper. That, you know, when you talk about inequality, most people will say, well, we got to solve this with education. And, you know, it's clear you can see the correlation with, you know, your education level and how you do. But then poverty just seems to be a revolving cycle, and the tools that we're supposed to be using to help that are more and more closed off. All right, so, but is inequality really growing? Right, if you saw, I think it was this week or last week, the recent census report is beginning to challenge that narrative of wage stagnation. Right, and so the median income of America actually rose by 3.2% after inflation, and the median income in America right now is actually the highest it's ever been.
What is it?
It's around $52,000. Don't quote me, but that's I didn't write it down.
It's the median?
It's per household. Median income per household.
That's much higher than I would have thought.
And then as well, poverty has finally reached pre-recession levels, and it's on the decline for every ethnic group. Doesn't mean that people aren't poor, because still right now poverty is at 40.6 million, but that is about 12.7% down from, no, I'm sorry, that's 40.6 million, which is about 12.7% of the population, but that's down from the 13.5% it was in 2015. So how do we understand the competing, you know, narratives of wage stagnation versus, wait a second, take a snapshot of the economy and what's going on? People argue that the decline in poverty and when what we see is and the rise of the median income is not just because, I want to say, the economy is sharing better, but it's also safety net programs like Social Security, tax credits, food stamps. housing subsidies. That's kind of what's really helping pull people out of poverty. And then if you change it and now go back to education and look at education, still we see a large gap. 25% of people without a high school diploma are living in poverty. And then 13.3% of the population with a high school and no college is living in poverty, but only 4.5% of those with a bachelor's degree that are in the population are living in poverty. And income inequality still persists. Just going to read you part of it. Of course, if I grab the right one. So it says here, despite the improvements in poverty and income across ethnic groups, the American economy is still characterized by significant income inequality. While the poor are finally finding more stable footing following the recession, the rich have been doing well for quite some time now. The average household income of the top 20% of Americans grew by about $14,000 from a decade ago, while the average household income of the bottom 20% of Americans fell about $600 in that same time period. The top 20% of earners made 51.5% of all the income in the U.S. last year, while the bottom 20% made 3.5%. And then what we're also seeing is economic growth is uneven regionally. Right, so they're saying, actually, when we're saying the median household income in the Midwest only grew 0.9% from last year. And so if you kind of look around, I think in the South it was 3.9%, and then on the West Coast it was 3.3%. Right? So we're seeing that, you know, how that's kind of being shaped around the country. So we can see that growing inequality due to wages being decoupled from productivity, there's clear markers in education, and then there's also clear markers in America regionally of just what's going on with growing inequality. And this is, you know, the disappearance of work, we can also say, has massive social implications. Right? William Julius Wilson, another professor at Harvard, he wrote a book, When Work Disappears. And he essentially was in urban neighborhoods showing the effects of, you know, people argue about what's the problem in the inner city, what's the problem in the urban neighborhoods, and then he just goes in and essentially says, hey guys, guess what? Work. You know, no one's like, you know, and then he's kind of showing how, because of the loss of work, that is actually leading to the social breakdown. That's leading, you know, to the drugs, that's leading to increased, you know, violence interpersonally between men and women, and all of these things, he was tracking it back to work. And then also, I think they, in Youngstown, Ohio, where it used to be, you know, a booming steel city, but when all the jobs left, guess what happened? You know, drugs increased, interpersonal violence, and just the social cohesion began to rip apart. So as we have wages being decoupled from productivity and the ability to find a livable wage, and as we see where the education struggles are, and add on top of that technology, the question still remains, the future of work, what are we going to do? And then how are we going to distribute the wealth? Because it's not that we're not making money. So technology, what's happening with technology? Technology in the best sense provides tools that are practical and helpful, right? I'm going to Nigeria next month, and I'm going to get on a plane. I'm not going to get on a boat, right? So I'm going to fly over the Atlantic Ocean as opposed to, you know, get here on the boat. That's a great thing, right? I actually am excited about that. It's going to take me, you know, I'm going to fly to Atlanta, then from Atlanta, straight shot to drop me right in Lagos, Nigeria. And it's, you know, it's going to be nice. So I think that's a good thing. The internal combustion engine actually gives me a job. That's how I make my living, right? But the technologies of our current day are transforming our world, right? Artificial intelligence, machine learning, and deep learning. So artificial intelligence, the term was actually coined in 1955 by a professor at Dartmouth. And then machine learning, when we say machine learning, What do we mean by that? We mean the machine's ability to keep improving its performance without humans having to explain or code exactly how to accomplish the task that it's given. And then we'll talk about deep learning as well. So, there have been significant breakthroughs after many years of slow grinding pace with artificial intelligence, machine learning, and deep learning. Right? The main reason being artificial intelligence has finally broken through Michael Polanyi's, he was a philosopher and scientist, his paradox of we know more than we can tell. Right? So a lot of times, the way that I can actually codify an activity is if it's repeatable, and I understand exactly every step. Right? So one of the biggest challenges, in the early days of artificial intelligence, for example, is go and sit in the chair, right? All human beings, they can say, the chair, this wooden, shape is a chair, but then also this couch over here is a chair. So we're kind of able to intuitively understand that, and we can kind of go do that. And sometimes it's as well when you're trying to, when you try to take somebody that has no clue about something and you want to write step-by-step directions of exactly how they would do it, we usually get it wrong, right? Because a lot of times that's that Polanyi's paradox of we just know more than we can tell. And so if you can't program it into artificial intelligence, it's hard for it to actually do something, right? And so, but at current, they're actually making lots and lots of advances really, really fast, right? And they're mainly in perception and cognition, right? So perception, there's been lots of advances in just speech and voice recognition, right? If anybody remembers when Siri first came out on the iPhone, it was very, very, very bad, right? but just, as the years have gone on, right, it's just gotten tremendously better. And then now I think with the new iPhone, everybody knows that facial recognition is actually coming out now. And that, ironically enough, when Michael Polanyi was writing, that's one of the things where he said he didn't think that machines would be able to do, right? But they're actually being able to do that now. I heard of a study, I didn't see it myself, but I've read of it where the guys at MIT campus, they made like an artificial cheetah. And so like they made the cheetah's like running around the track and they're throwing things at it as it like intuitively is learning to get out of the way of the things that are being thrown at it, right? And then, as well as cognition, that's where they're making a lot of advances, right? So I think this is probably an old story, but machines beating human beings at games, right? This was probably a big deal back in the day, but at this point it's like, duh, okay, fine, machines can beat humans at games, it's all right. And then IBM's Watson was actually, it got trained by the top medical professionals, right? And so they were trying to train it to detect diseases, right? So essentially, if you pump at it a lot of data, it can go through a lot of papers and it can be trained by the top medical professionals, then, hey, this your machine can actually detect diseases pretty well. And then a lot of companies are using it to just make decisions right now, like decision-making companies. How do we decide on making, like a trade? So it's being used to make some money as well. So just kind of broadly decision-making is another way that artificial intelligence is being used. So then when you go to machine learning, the biggest difference, I think, of machine learning right now, but from like machine learning to deep learning, is that deep learning uses neural networks to just go through large amounts of data, right? So the biggest difference is that instead of programming the machine learns from examples and lots of data. So essentially, they're saying the machine can learn if you just kind of show it, give it an example. Like if I was trying to program a machine to pick up a cup, I can give it lots of data and I can show it, oh, you grab this and you pick it up and I want you to do it. And then it can kind of pick up on that. And that's, one of the ways where people are like really using deep learning. And so And that's one of the reasons why I think there's been a lot of chatter and a lot of fear just all around data, right? Because now big data can just be used in so many interesting ways, right? If I can just, I can literally figure out your life using statistics, and if you just give me so much data over time, I can, I mean, like, actually, when I get in my car in the morning, like, my phone automatically tells me, like, where work is, right? It's like 11 minutes to work, and it's just, I'm just like, it actually freaks me out every time. It's like, how do you know today? So, okay, no one at my job can hear this, but usually around 10 or 10:30, I go get some coffee from Starbucks. Starbucks 5 minutes away, so it's like I come in, I get to work, I drop my stuff, have a meeting or something like that, and it's like, you know what? I gotta get some coffee. So I go to Starbucks. So today, I wasn't going to Starbucks, but I went to my car and sat down, and my phone just gave me the Starbucks 5 minutes away. I was like, this is crazy. But, you know, so with large amounts of data and neural networks, the machines can kind of learn on their own. They can kind of essentially, like, detect. And I think the way that a lot of the people working on this found this out is that, say, if you program it to play a game and you program it a certain amount of moves, but then the machine might do something that you didn't program in there. It's like, well, how did you figure that out? We didn't even think that was a possibility. But because it's going through so much data really, really fast, it just might be able to see things that we might not have been able to see. Right? And so I think clearly and obviously that freaks people out. Right? And so I think one of the biggest risks that the scientists working on this is that humans sometimes have a hard time figuring out why the machine made that decision, right? So, like, that's just like, what's going on here? And so I think that I was reading the same guys that wrote The Second Machine Age that work at MIT. They wrote a paper recently just about this, and they had three risks in there. And so the three risks were... I'm going to put it slightly differently than they put it, so this is not a direct quote. But the first one was, machines duplicate the biases that they see. Right, so the way I say that is, machines duplicate the biases that we already have in society. So, for example, if you're using this to, like, give a loan out at the bank, right, and then the last 1,000 people that you gave a loan out to at the bank looked a certain way, then when another person that looks differently from them comes in, it's just automatically going to deny them because you've taught the machine, the bias that you've already had, right? So if you perceive a certain type of person to be dangerous, and then the machine, the machine is just going to pick that up, and it's just going to almost be a mirror back to you on the biases that you already have, right? Then the next risk that they put forth were that the neural networks are built on statistics. And so the way that I interpret that is, well, then this means that the neural networks are built on a world that has no absolutes, right? Because essentially, it's hard to have complete confidence that something will always work, right? Because we just base some logic off things that are literal, but this is just basing things on, so that it's hard to have statistics that's 100%. So it's not, so it, like, things may fail 0.001% of the time. So you just won't know, like, you can't say with absolute confidence this is always going to be what it's supposed to be. And then another risk that they posed was, when errors are made, it's hard to diagnose, like, how and why the error was made, because it's based on stats, and you might not necessarily, if it's 98% confidence, well, why did it fail that 2%? It could be a number of any reasons, right? So it's almost, it reminds me of at work, we have, like, failure modes. And when you, like, you get 10 engineers around, and we're all just spouting out, well, it could have been this, 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 it could have been this. So it's, you start up. And then this other thing I read in their paper that I just found that was really, really interesting. They were trying to now argue what are the right limits to set for how we use this. And then they said that computer intelligence is good at giving you answers, but they cannot pose the questions, right? So I just thought that that was, you know, a very, very interesting point that, yeah, I mean, they can, might have all this power to, like, you know, it might see a possibility that you didn't see, and it's, but it's lit, even if it's like the things that it's learning, it's just giving you the answers, but it's actually not, you know, posing the questions, right? So it's probably not gonna answer my favorite question, is what are human beings for? Like, you know, what are we, it's not even gonna pose that question to you, right? Like, what should we be doing? It might be able to tell you, you know, how to make a lot of money, but to, you know, to Dick's point, okay, now what should I do with it? Right? So there's definitely clear, limitations, and I personally think that it's possibly an impenetrable place and difference between, some of the advances that we're seeing in this technology of our day versus, what human beings can do. Right? But then what are the implications of all this new technology on work? Right? I think that the implications of this is, one, it's going to continue the hollowing out of the middle class that we see, right? Because it's hard to put a boundary around, what it can learn. And a lot of times it's, the way I kind of see it going is, it was going really, 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 really slow in the beginning, and then all of a sudden it just took over everything, because it's just hard to put a boundary around it. You just, okay, it can do this, it can do this, it can do this. And I mean, obviously, look, one of the biggest problems is it's hard for us in human society to really be firm on ends and means, you know? And so what are the ends and means of this technology? If you ask maybe some of the people that are developing it, they probably couldn't give you a straight answer. I think, you know, some industries and professions might become obsolete, right? So I mean, they're already using a lot of what's happening in Asia right now, because the economy is aging. They actually need these technologies to keep up their level of production, right? Because if there's not, you know, as people age, they, you know, there's people that are of working age, there's just not enough around to get enough of the work done. So it's like, well, if we want to keep producing at this level, we're just going to need machines to go into the labor force. And there's an interesting statistic going on right now with work, is that in America, the share of prime-aged men who are neither working or looking for work has doubled since 1970. And I think just because technology and or globalization, however you want to argue it, is already, you know, taking out a lot of these jobs, then a lot of prime age men are just deciding to stay out of the economy. And then you can also argue there's the gig economy that has come up, and it's not necessarily traditional, and there's not a lot of laws and rules around it because people don't really know how to control it as of yet. But I think that could be increasingly where the world goes, is that, well, I kind of got to be my own boss. I know what my skills are. And then essentially there's just, you know, I need to provide a service. So you have all these, you know, Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, TaskRabbit, where you can just kind of, you know, come on when you want to, and then someone's looking for a service, and you just kind of do that. So I think increasingly I can see that going, our world going in that direction, but that also poses significant challenges. And then the other implication I feel like on work of all these advances is there's actually an increasing number of economists that claim America specifically is suffering from a productivity slump, and we actually need these technologies to keep up on our productivity slump, right? So it's, you know, we're actually, you know, we're not becoming more productive. As I said in the beginning, you know, a part of our American religion is industriousness. And it's like, wait, this isn't happening. And so a lot of people are blaming, they're saying that we actually need these robots to do this work. And they're saying that companies actually aren't investing as much as, you know, some economists argue they should in these new technologies. And then new jobs and different type of jobs are also, you know, arguing aren't being created. So people are actually arguing that we need more of this, and we need more of it faster. And then I at this point, there's another quote from Neil Postman. I think he wrote something about like five ways to think about technology. And I thought that this was just rather interesting just to note and to be mindful of. He says, technology change is not additive, it's ecological. And what he means by that, he gives the example of if you have a clear cup of water and you put a drop of red dye in there, you don't have a drop of red dye in a, you know, clear glass of water. You have, you know, something that's been fundamentally changed. And so I think just as, because it's really hard to predict where all of this is going, but the one thing that we could probably say for sure is, you know, to his first point, technology gives and it takes away, so it's going to create a certain way of being, a certain way of interacting, you know, and I think it's also not neutral, right? It also, technology also has a, it creates a certain way of being human that's just going to be ecological. I think we have to be prepared and ready for that. All right. That's, and then although many people may be anxious and fear the end of work, and they look at all these trends and changes, let's be honest, work is annoying, right? Today's Friday, and today you probably said to somebody, TGIF, thank goodness it's Friday, right? On Monday, you're going to go to work, and you're going to look at somebody, and you're going to say, I have a case of the Mondays, right? On Wednesday, you're going to go to work, and you're going to look around, and you're going to put a smile on your face when someone's not that chipper, and you're going to say, hey, cheer up, it's hump day. Right? That means work is almost done. Right? So we have all these ways of, you know, getting ourselves through the week. It's like, ah, you're sad that I got a case of the Mondays. Fridays, you got to be happy. I mean, come on, work is over now. We get, you know, freedom for 2 days. Right? So on one hand, we can be anxious and agitated saying, oh man, work is going to end. But then, you know, the paradox of work, I read this recently, said the paradox of work is that many people hate their jobs, but they are considerably more miserable doing nothing. Right? And, you know, one of the questions, you know, being posed by people that really cheer this on, well, first of all, they're saying, like, to the first stats that I let off, that, like, actually, Americans are working too much. They have an over-obsession with work. They, now, like, now technology has actually allowed you to take the office home with you. Right now, before you can just leave it there, but now people work from home, they have their laptops, and they're supposed to be working 40 hours, but you're probably not working 40 hours, you're probably working 80, and then you're thinking about it, and then you go on vacation, and your manager can text you now, and he can say, oh, but wait, your email's on your phone, I need you to read that email and give me a response now. But what are you talking about? I'm at Disney World. I don't care. Give me a response. So it's like, it's like, it goes, it's not a personal story. It's not.
But
I wasn't at Disney World. I was just, that's for the families, you know, that are Disney World. So, got it. So, and this is why I think, you know, right now I think we have an opportunity to really help people solve this paradox of work and think about work in more healthy ways, right? So there was a 2014 Gallup survey that came out that said 70% of Americans feel dissatisfied with their jobs. And then we also have something in America right now called retirement. And there was another thing, according to the, I think it was Nielsen survey that came out, retired seniors watch 50 hours of television a week. So, and then another survey that came out recently was, it surveyed what people do with their time that are not working. It's a survey of the jobless. And then what I found interesting was particularly men spend their free time watching television and or browsing the internet. Right, so we have this paradox of work where many people hate their jobs, but they are considerably more miserable doing nothing. And then we also spoke of before how what happens, you know, to society when joblessness persists for a long time? Do we just get into lots of unhealthy behaviors? So how do we solve this paradox of work? And I think the Christian faith in particular gives us the tools to kind of solve these challenges, and it gives us a basis of kind of understanding this paradox. Right? And putting work in the broader story of creation, fall, redemption, I think is very, at least for me, it's very, very helpful. Mm-hmm. Right? Because God created all of us in his image, and then pre the fall, before the fall, he places Adam in a garden and he gives him work to do. And that's a good thing. So that's where we can understand one side of the paradox. You're actually going to be considerably miserable not working. Because in very real ways, work was meant to be a part of what it means to live a good life. But then we have the fall, right? The fall happens, and as a result of the fall, work is cursed. So it's supposed to be toilsome. So a lot of times, work can be frustrating. Even if you get your dream job, it's actually probably going to have some fruitless times. It's probably going to involve some toil. And although you may be more satisfied with it, it's just not going to be perfect, right? Because even now we're actually living, you know, post-Jesus, and a lot of people call it the, you know, the... Now, not yet. Yeah,
already and not yet.
Yes, the already and the not yet. Where it's, you know, some of the effects of the fall, there can be some real and substantial healing, but it's just not going to be perfect. So even, you know, on your best month at your job, your perfect job, there still may be some fruitlessness. But then, for me, that just gives such a helpful way of explaining the paradox, because I think so many people have just accepted the fact that work is going to suck. I'm going to have a case on Mondays every Monday, and I'm going to be so thankful it's Friday every Friday, and not set back to, you know, actually look, hey, wait a second. So you actually mean to tell me we were born, we go to school, we go to work for X amount of years, and then we retire and we watch television for 50 hours a week and then we die? Are you kidding me? Like, that just does not sound exciting. Right? And it's, if you've accepted that for yourself, I mean, wait a second. So you mean you're going to be working for the next X amount of years and you're going to be miserable? And it's like sometimes some of my friends tell me, they're like, they get on the train, they look at everybody's face, and they just know they're miserable. And so I think that putting work in the correct story is actually just going to be more healthy for you. You're actually probably going to live a better life if you can understand work, because it's such a central part of your life. And, you know, if you win the lottery and you go and do nothing, you're probably going to feel really bad about yourself. I didn't mean for that to be fun. I was actually being serious. So I think that uniquely the Christian faith can solve this paradox of work. Then I think as well, we have work can become our identity in very, very unhelpful and unhealthy ways. Right? So a lot of times people go out and they say, I hate going out because once I meet somebody, they're going to ask me my name and then they're going to ask me, what do I do? Right? And so everyone just, I just don't like it. It's almost like a way of just, you know, stratifying me right away. So it's like, hey, what do you do? This is like a real big status symbol. Like, well, I'm a doctor. Oh, wow, interesting. And then, as you know, somebody says, well, I'm a butcher. Okay, all right. So how'd you get in here? And like, so it's like, we just use this as almost like a pass in society in very unhealthy ways, because work becomes your identity. And then as work becomes more deeply your identity, if you're doing good at work, you're going to be very, very, very happy, and you'll probably be arrogant. And then if you're doing poorly at work, you're probably going to get depressed because you're just so tied in there. And so we actually need a healthy way to free ourselves to at least fight against this tendency for work to become your identity. I remember one time we were in New York. We were doing, I run a discussion on Monday nights called Diving Deeper. So we were recording videos for our identity series. And so we were at Central Park. We stopped this lady. We were going to ask her some questions about identity. And so I think the question we asked her was, how do you define yourself? And she thought for like 20 seconds. And, you know, she started defining herself. And as I started asking her more questions, she said, she admitted, I struggle because the way, like, what I'm passionate about is not how I make my money. So when you're asking me how do I define myself, I don't really want to say that I'm this because I just do that for money. But what I'm really passionate about is this. But in my creative pursuits, I haven't really made any money on it yet. So I don't really know if I can have that be a part of my identity. But she was just, I just saw her like there just as she was thinking about it, just struggling. I was like, man, you know, work can really become our identity in very unhealthy ways. And I think, you know, we have this thing in America called retirement. So if people just, a lot of times they're about to end their job and they're like, oh, what, like, who am I now? I have a very big, real struggle with identity. And I think that's another one of the reasons, especially in America, why joblessness can be so hard, because it's like, you know, go be productive, you know, go be industrious, go figure out something to do. But if joblessness persists for a little bit, it can be, you know, really, I mean, it can be damaging already, but just the way that we are in society where it becomes your identity, it's just very, very, very unhealthy. So we have to have our identity rooted somewhere else, right? Because if it's rooted in work, even if you're doing well at work, at some point you're probably going to be doing bad, but if you're doing well, you're probably going to be intolerable and arrogant. And that's just not a good and healthy way to live. So I think we need healthy ways of dealing, I would say, with the danger of work, because it can actually, it can turn you into someone that you don't want to be. And then so many people, I feel like, are desperate to have some type of fulfillment and meaning in their work. And so it's like, I don't want to quote unquote work a dead end job. I don't want to feel stuck in what I'm doing. I want to go to work and feel like I'm making a difference in the world, for example. And there was a Yale professor of management, Amy Wierzynski. She says that people mainly work for three reasons. You have a job where you're just doing it to make money, or you have a career, you know, you get some level of social status from it. Or you have a calling, right? You feel like you know, you're getting some meaning and purpose behind that. And when I heard that, I agree. Because sometimes people just, they can find themselves in one of those three things. But we have unique dangers, I feel like, with this idea of calling, especially when it becomes secularized, right? Because now the big thing is it's, you know, sometimes people, they speak as if they're on like this alchemist journey to find that moment or that thing when they just, oh yeah, that was it and that was my time. And, you know, the question that I think needs to be asked back is, well, what was calling you? like, was it actually a person there that you were responding to? If not, then are you okay? And then I think as well, in times of transition, you know, people can really struggle in unique ways with, okay, well, now what do I do now? And if people consistently find themselves unfulfilled, they really start to question a lot of things. And I think that, you know, recovering some sense of calling and a language for it where we can, you know, kind of push people to consider these things in a healthy way, especially at work, I think is very, very helpful. Because I try with some of my friends to just to really, okay, well, why are you doing that? Okay, I want to go do this. Well, why? And having some way of evaluating who you are, your skills, and how you feel like you want to work and or serve the world. And I try to tell some of my friends, this is your life, actually. You know, you're going to blink and be, you know, so far down the road, you got to be wise and make the right decision with how you're doing these things. And I think as well, it has massive implications for education, because we're seeing how, you know, education levels, you know, is really kind of determining where you are in society. But then so many times you go to college, and college freshmen, they don't have a clue what they want to do, right? So, like, and it's, you know, really connecting some sense of calling, you know, work and industry, some sense of making something of the world in a healthy way. I think our culture is in desperate need of it, right? Because the misery of corporate America sometimes is, you can feel it. Like, none of us are happy here. Come on, stop. So, as well, I think probably lastly, the challenge for, you know, those who are Christians of whatever you do, do it with all your heart, right? And then, you know, the rest of that says, you know, you should work as unto the Lord. And so as I evaluate my last 5 days that I worked, I exchanged my labor for capital in the American market. Did I do what I was doing as unto the Lord? Did I work with all my heart? And then the other thing, there's nothing more exciting than seeing somebody who is actually passionate about something, right? And so it's in what they're doing, they're passionate about it. Sometimes that passion is contagious, right? And so there's the challenge for me of whatever you do, do it with all of your heart, right? And I think sometimes there's that fight to, I mean, I know for me, I think I was telling some of my friends three or four weeks ago, I walk into work, I dock my laptop, I signed in, then I looked around, I said, I don't want to be here. So I went to my car. I need a break. Like, and I actually had like a existential crisis. What am I doing with my life? Like, why am I still here? Why am I at this job? Like, and I had to really, you know, wrestle with that. And I also think we have to think about industries from a macro level to try to get some sense of, okay, what am I actually doing in the world? Right? So, like, I think of, you know, engineering from a macro level of, well, we're trying to understand the natural world, and you're trying to take materials and make helpful things for human flourishing. Right? On your best days, when upper management is not making any sense, okay, what are we doing here right now? We're trying to take, you know, raw materials in the world, understand what the needs are, mold them and shape them in the right way to help human flourishing, right? Or like, you know, doctors, for example, what are you doing in the world? Like, what is your whole profession trying to accomplish at a macro level? And then how do you fit into that on a micro level, right? So, and I think that for me is a helpful way of thinking about your skills and your calling. It's like, okay, well, if you feel like you have some gifting in this area, well, on a macro level, what is your profession doing, and how do you fit in there? I think it's just very, very, at least for me, I had to, because when I started working, I was really struggling with what is the point of this. And it's hard for me when people are just telling me what to do, you know, go design this bracket. Why? Who cares? Where is it going? What's happening to it? Like, okay, what are we really doing here? And it's like, so for me, and then as well, just trying to connect, you know, your faith and your work in some healthy way, and find some sense of meaning and calling, and that you're responding to something, and that you're doing something of value in the world. I think looking at professions on these macro levels, and then sometimes I think even in encouraging people who are entrepreneurial, it's like, okay, well, what do you feel like, you know, that we need in the world? Well, how would you accomplish that? What kind of organization would you build up? What kind of people do you need to bring around you to, you know, bring that forth? And then trying to, sometimes right now I'm almost getting afraid when you're seeing with the way the world is going, to like pursue your passions. Yes, please pursue your passions. Please do that, but maybe get a data science degree if you want to get a job in the American economy, right? So it's there's that that twin balance, I think, for me, of how do we now balance practicality and passion in very real ways to live healthier lives. I think that will be all the remarks for me tonight. All right, great. So I think we have a time of discussion afterwards, so we can pick up about anything.
Have you read much Arlie Marshchild? She's written, I read several of her books, but several years ago, but she wrote a book called There's No Place Like Work, talking about how more and more people would rather be at work than at home with the messiness of children and chaos and irregularity and, you know, not being able to control things, and that in fact Americans overwhelmingly are not taking the parental leaves they have, they're not taking the vacation time they have, because they'd rather be at work than at home. And in fact, she was tracking on the way in which a lot of the traditional work of a mother or a father or a parent is outsourced. Now you can pay people to, I remember when my kids were in college, this just made me sick. I would get things in the mail saying, we will send your child a personalized letter and cake for his birthday at college. So that I didn't have to send my kid a birthday card. Because so I could pay someone to send my kid a birthday card and a care package, etc. And she was just raising, I think, really good questions about, you can dial a grandma. For a child who is scared at home, who comes home to an empty house, and wants to talk to a grown up, and you can pay to dial a grandma, and an older woman will talk to them, comfort them on the phone, and I think Arlie Marshchild is rightly asking questions about, well, what does parenting mean anymore? What does mothering or fathering mean anymore? When people would rather be at the workplace and outsource everything that has to do with. I mean, have you thought anything? Because that's another interesting thing is that in this economy, there are more and more people just coming up with all sorts of inventing ways of earning money, being an organizer, going in and organizing people's houses, just starting up businesses, whether it's, you know, being a dial grandma who will get paid for listening to lonely children, on the phone, or...
I think that's very interesting on a lot of levels, where even on the parenting piece, I think right now we're seeing, well, people just aren't having kids anymore. the birth rate is down. And I think there was a study done by University of Chicago people that said even people that complain about work, lots of time would rather be at work. They essentially made that same argument. They would rather be at work than being at home and doing these things. So some people, and there's a lot of overwork we see, and sometimes people also give a claim to some of the things that you brought up. And as well as in the gig economy, with the way that we do services now, sometimes it feels like to me we're like offshoring any type of physical labor or discomfort, right? So anything that I don't feel like doing, right? Because especially the way the economy is going, where there's so many people that are just looking for work, or they're not getting paid enough money, so they just got to do they just need to do extra things. So because the people that have all the money, it's like, you know what, you know, it's, I don't feel like, you know, hanging up my clothes right now and cleaning my room. Let me get on this new app that, you know, I can just task somebody else to come in and do it for me. So it's just, I think that technology is almost in some ways creating those types of people, because it's like everything should be easy, instant, and now. So that's just going to create a certain way of being, right? It's like certain conveniences I should just have, because, you know, I don't have to sit here and wait 10 minutes for this, or I don't even have to, I can just... In New York, what's big with a lot of my friends is washing full. I don't want to sit down at a laundromat. I just pack up my clothes, you know, take it to this store, I drop it off, they wash and fold it for me. And the smarter ones, they just, there's an app, you can just schedule it, boom, they come to your house, they just pick up your laundry, they take it, they wash, and they bring it right back to you. So there's just so many things that are happening in the service economy that you can do, you know. And there's just, for me, there's just so much inequality in that, where it's like, well, I don't fight doing all these things, I have enough disposable income, yeah, and there's enough people that don't have good jobs that, like, you know, well, yeah, come wash my clothes for me, you know, because so, I don't feel like doing it. So that's just.
So it makes me think of more of the old European aristocracy, right, who lived that way with servants in their homes doing all these things. Mm-hmm. And America was, I guess for several hundred years, has been more egalitarian, mm-hmm, and people wanted to leave behind the old aristocracy.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a natural movement of society.
That's essentially where Thomas Piketty finished his book off, saying that we're actually going back to that time because of capital and labor. So lots of economists don't like that, and they argue with him very hard, but there's also lots of people on his side saying that's where we can see it really going.
What about more and more people essentially feeling like they do belong, even though they wouldn't say it in words, feeling like they do belong to the aristocracy in terms of their expectations of
them? Mm.
So, you know, this is what entitlement is. I actually feel like entitlement, the term comes from like having a title.
There are certain
rights that are due to you. That when you, your whichever question you asked at the beginning, are you anxious about the future of work? Are you not? I said anxious, not so much because of the automation, although that does freak me out too.
Yeah.
But more anxious by the complete loss of work ethic in a generation,
sure,
and that's replaced with basic entitlement.
Sure, sure.
Like, I should get all this stuff I want, and I don't know how to work.
Yeah.
And that's what's most scary to me in terms of overall lack of productivity in the country.
Yeah.
To me, it makes sense to me that it's not just that AI and automation is taking away jobs from good, hardworking Americans. It's like, maybe it is making up for a gap in productivity.
Yeah.
Whatever you said that. Okay.
Yeah.
That to me is even almost more scary. Just think of the way in which, sure, we're miserable when we're not working, but all of the things we can do to distract ourselves now from that misery.
Yeah.
And so, virtual reality, entertainment.
Yeah.
It's just improved unbelievably.
Yeah.
And who can be bothered with reality anymore? If I can sit on my couch without a job and just like go and do whatever I want virtually.
Yeah.
So that to me is an even more scary thing about it. It's not just that computers are edging out good, hardworking Americans. It's like how many people really want to work?
I don't know. It's a good point.
Scary.
And then I think even to that point, what some of the things I was reading, and a lot of people really speaking to like the reformers and like Martin Luther really arguing hard for the dignity of all work. But sometimes it feels like in our society as Americans, because first of all, there's like a blue collar, white collar stratosphere divide, right? But then, you know, like now all the blue collar traditional jobs are going away and we just become, you know, more white collar workers. So there's that divide, and then now with the ease of how life is supposed to be, to your point, it's like I won't go and like wash my own clothes. Why? I have an app for that. You know what I mean? So it's like it seems to be that almost, if we lose that dignity of all work, then there's just some things that, you know, well, that's beneath me, and I'm like a 21st century educated, you know, MIT graduates. I don't need to go and wash my clothes. What's, you know, like, so it's interesting.
This is a small example, but I started a job where I am working with college students, they're in college, and this is for a small example. We had a pile of checks to look through to give to people. And so at this point, we hadn't put them all on a spreadsheet. And I said, okay, I'm looking for a check for, you know, Bob Jones. Do I have to look through all of these checks? How else are you going to find it? Like, you have to go through all the checks. There are 200 checks. But they're not filed, so you're going to look at, like, what a... I was thinking, it's just like, it was mind-boggling. It's like, yes, how else will we find Bob Jones' check? like, the phone, yesterday, one of operations manager came over and said, are you working? He's like, how am I, well, the one moment on my phone, you know, now you see me, I was working before, he said, I'm going to take your phone. And then just like the sense of like, no, like, I should be able to have my phone and check my text, listen to music. Not at work. And it's kind of the norm. And then one day I was talking with the operation manager, he's in his 50s, and it's like, this isn't a volunteer opportunity. And he said, you know, he was giving a talk about, just like, you don't, once upon a time, if you don't like a job, then you, there's a door, someone else will take your job. And people do need jobs. So just kind of like a sense of, I'm entitled to have a job and get paid for it, but I only want to do what I feel like. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody
else?
I'd like to hear an update at your cubicle meets there.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I'm self-employed, and yeah. I've always said I never want to work at a cubicle meet. Thank goodness. To date, I haven't had to work at a cubicle.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated the story about the cubicle meets.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm still currently working on my corner office at Pratt & Whitney. They don't recognize my importance to the organization, so to the point of entitlement, sorry, I have to indulge. I would quickly jump at the chance to get out of the worker bee cube. But I am in a new cube now, though. I moved, so I don't have a corner office yet, but, you know, we have... to make us feel more important, they have like taller walls now. So it's only me right here and another guy next to me, right? So, and he's only there 3 times a week and they have taller walls. So I feel like I have a corner office, but no windows. And I'm going to put some pictures up. I haven't put any pictures up at their head. So right now, that's my current cube life, Mondays to Fridays. So.
So I guess one question is, what level of automation do you think would be ideal in our society right now? I have a particular scenario in mind. The reason I'm even here in Massachusetts, New England area, is because I'm working at an Amazon fulfillment center,
yep.
Getting it ready to launch in. The jobs, like, I work for the company that puts in sorters and stuff to help automate stuff inside the warehouse. But the jobs we're creating there, it's really mundane tasks.
Yeah.
And I can see a lot of workers there. They're not really thrilled to be there.
Yeah.
So I know that my company, it's like trying to automate stuff like that even
yeah.
more. So what is like the ideal automation level?
That is a hard question to even imagine, because you always have to have trade-offs. And then I guess for me, I would automatically go to what are the ends and what are the means, right? So are the ends to just make the production center or production centers or even society as efficient as possible? I don't know if that is the end, right? Is the end for all people who want to work to have the ability to work as well? I mean, that sounds great, but a lot of jobs take different skills and they take different, it requires a certain, you know, type of, you know, to be in school and get your PhD, it's going to require a lot of certain type of skills that's going to build up in you to have your, to have that job be there. And then I also get weary of people that look at technology as, well, technology is just going to do all the work that we don't feel like doing so that we can do the work that we want to do. Some people have that view. So that's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know. But For me, it's in society, it would, I think we would have to have some agreement on what are the ends of society, and kind of what ends are we going for? And then hopefully what, you know, is technology or automation, is it a means to get us there? Is it the right means to get us there? That's how I would think about it. I want to punt the question to Dick a little bit because I just want to hear his thoughts on it, to be honest. So.
I would, you know, you're dealing with, as you said, a lot of different competing things. And, you know, do you want a frustration-free workplace that's unproductive?
Or, yeah.
What is it? Obviously, you're going to have, in a real world, you're going to have to make some sort of combination of not get all you want of everything.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's not a new problem. It's a problem with any job, anywhere. We want to make this fun and enjoyable and so on, or do we want to actually get a lot of work done very efficiently in a certain time and get on to something else quickly?
Yeah.
It's a balancing act. And I think, in a sense, good management is sensitive enough to people to work out what adds to the job that needs to be done to, I mean, you've used the word, which is a good word, I think, that people working there will flourish.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's certainly a goal for us, but that's a delicate operation.
Yeah.
And a specific operation for the people that are there, the jobs, the backgrounds, all sorts of things. There's no textbook on that.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not trying to be an answer at all, but I was just thinking of if efficiency is the main purpose of life, you know, it can even, I'm just thinking of Amazon, the idea that, you know, I can order something online and have a drone delivered to my house within 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That feeds into the entitlement. You know, it's my right to be able to think of something I want and be able to get it in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there's something weird about that. Is efficiency the hot? Should efficiency be the highest goal in life?
Yeah.
Or the quickness, you know, that I can get what I want as absolutely quickly as possible?
No. Yeah. One thing I was thinking in connection to that is just this concept of time. So when you're talking about technology and efficiency and things being automated, there's this time piece. So it's like, What are we doing with that time? Like, if you don't have to spend a couple hours at the laundromat doing your laundry, where maybe you sit there and read a book or read a magazine or stare out the window or daydream or whatever.
Or talk to someone.
Or talk to someone else in music or whatever you do. Like, all of a sudden you have 3 extra hours, or right? But then what do you do? Are you like sitting on the couch in alternate reality?
Yeah.
You know, like, what, there's this sort of time component to this, and I was telling, somebody the other day, my dad is 71, and he just retired, but I remember when he got email at work, whatever that was, 15 years ago, or whatever, 20 years ago, and it's like the bane of his existence, and
really?
He's like, you know what I used to do before I had email? My job. And he's like, now, he was like, I mean, whenever he would take vacation, he would sometimes go into the office the night before or get it. He's like, I just have to go through these emails I can't get any work done tomorrow. You know, and so there's this idea of, like, email is this, like, time-saving thing. It's so easy. You don't have to walk across and talk to somebody. You don't have to have a meeting. You could just send them a note. But then it's sort of eating our time in a certain way. But then these other things are, well, the groceries just get dropped off at my house and the laundry gets dropped off and, you know, the clothes get delivered to my door, and I don't have to go buy clothes. So I have all this time. So then, we're not working.
Yeah.
You know?
It's.
I don't know.
Because, like, the funny thing about that is, like, when, so some of the they're called post workers that are celebrating this. They're saying that, well, maybe we'll use our time to, you know, be better family people and spend more time with your family, as Marty was saying, where they're saying, you know, maybe it will free us to be more creative and be more artistic. So now it's like, you know, I think, I forgot that, I think it's Peter, is an economist, so he's really on the, you know, maybe we used to be artisans and now we'll go back to being artisans, or, you know, now we'll, it'll like, it'll teach us to, like somebody said, to like, to talk to somebody and go and do that, right? And so, but at the same time as you imagine that, you're also looking at people who are jobless now, and that's just not what they're doing, right? Some people, you know, are you know, there's also some people are like rearing children and caring for the elderly, but you know, lots of other people are just, you know, choosing to just sit around and, you know, Netflix and different things like that. So I think that's the, I don't know what we'll do, but I don't know if human beings are that good at using their time wisely. So I don't know if we excel that much at time management. Me personally, I'm probably an expert, but as for the rest of you guys, I don't know if you've learned that skill. It's a total joke.
This is shifting gears a bit, but I've been concerned, I mean, just being interested in social history and how kids used to grow up. Mm-hmm. Children used to be, from the time they were 5 or 6 years old, were actually doing real work as part of the family economy. Mm. And they were actually essential to life on a farm, in a shop, whatever. And a book that really communicates this well is Laura Ingalls Wilder's book, Farmer Boy, about this Almanzo, the guy that she ended up marrying, his growing up on the farm. And there was a sense of children just straining forward for the next responsibility to be able to grow into adulthood. And there was a total connection between the work they did as children and what they would do as adults. And they saw the meaning of it, and there was nowhere near the kind of crisis of meaning and boredom and so on that is such a problem today for kids growing up. I just read an article yesterday, or finished it yesterday, in The Atlantic, which was actually a very interesting article on research on how destructive cell phones are. And in all kinds of ways that not just, more unpredictable ways, but they're actually doing much less, and they're not getting out, and they're staying in their parents' home on their bed on their phones, and not participating in sports as much, not participating in... And one of the main things it says is kids used to have jobs.
Yeah.
Jobs, and fewer have, you know, have jobs. And I don't know. I think as you pointed out very well, you know, we were created, and God gave us dominion as part of being the image of God, and that involved work, and it's actually essential to being human. It's essential. Having some input into the world that you see that you make a difference is actually really important. And this article was talking about the rise in depression, suicidality, and loneliness as a result of people spending, particularly social media, and feeling more and more lonely because they're always checking out, and they realize when kids do get together, which isn't very often, but when kids actually get together, then they document it endlessly on Instagram and whatever.
It's a must, actually. You have to do it.
Because it worked there. feel left out and more lonely. But the not work, not working is another piece. It's so different from 100 years ago, or maybe even a little more now. But when kids were actually, they knew their work mattered. They knew it was part of their family needed their work. And... that's still true in many lower income places where kids, you know, can't go to school because they have to work.
Yeah.
They have to help support their family and so on. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is, but it's actually one of the blessings of LaBrie and of having raised kids in LaBrie, because it's so pre-industrial. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of work around that actually needs to be done, and our students have to do a lot of this work, and it's it actually has to be done to make the place run, but it's very kind of pre-industrial, you know, we're splitting wood for 9 wood burning stoves, but it's actual meaningful work because it helps the people that split wood in the summer are actually making it warm for the people that are here in the winter, and I don't know, there's something attractive about that.
How to undo, though, unwind that, like the cell phone thing, how do we ever wind that back, you know?
I don't know if we can. I don't think we can. I mean, and then as well, there's been lots of negatives that cell phones brought, but there's also been some positives, you know, like, you know, so it's like it's always a balancing act, right? Like, you know, when I was younger, growing up, my parents immigrated from Nigeria, so when they would call their family back home, like, you would always know because, like, there'd just be a lot of yelling on Saturday morning because they couldn't hear each other, right? So, can you hear me? No, I can't hear you. Speak up, oh, how are you doing? I am fine. Oh, so it's just like, that would wake you up on Saturday morning, right? But now, like, you just have WhatsApp and they can just, hey, how are you? And so it's like, wow, it's kind of like a big difference.
Don't you miss it a little
bit? No, I mean, like, a little bit is like Saturday morning, that's how you knew it was just, okay, we're talking to Nigeria, you have to go and like buy a calling card, you got to put it in, and then like in the middle of your conversation, you only have 3 minutes left, and then it drops. I mean, so like that, I can live without, right? If I just want to, I can, but, so there are some, and I think it's just, technology is going to prefer some ways of, I think it's just going to prefer some ways of, it's not neutral, right? It's going to encourage some things, it's going to discourage some things, and then I feel like we have to just fight for the right vision of what it means to be human. And then just as we live, these things are, we have to kind of learn how to live in with all these things. So it's like maybe, you know, take a cell phone Sabbath. I probably do that for myself. I'm not telling you I need to do that. I'm on my phone all the time.
Was thinking of my childhood. There wasn't cells. We got our first TV. I think I was like 8 years old. Mm. 8 to 18, I watched enough TV for a lifetime. Yeah. I've never owned a TV. So it's curious now when I think of it in that comparison. I wonder if the kids somehow, they're not going to go without a cell phone, but I wonder if saturation point, whatever, maybe when they hit their 30s or 40s, they might say, wow.
Well, a lot of kids are already talking about using words of addiction, saying, I can't put my phone down. They sleep with their phones. Their phone's the first thing the last thing they look at night, and the first thing they look at in the morning.
Well, it's an automation. Kids should be free running around outside of it, so this automation that owns them, you know?
Yes, this is, I'm just going to have a bit. This is kind of a response to the question you posed earlier, right? But I think that humans are often just afraid of the unknown, right? So we don't know what it's going to look like. So we all sit in this room kind of panicking, like, what is it going to look like 20 or 30 years from now, right? So I think when we think about technology and automation, right, it shouldn't disrupt our lives, it should improve our lives, right? So like you mentioned earlier, we shouldn't be doing repetitive tasks, right? Maybe we shouldn't be doing dangerous activities, right? Maybe humans shouldn't be disarming bombs, right? So maybe if we start using, so that way robots can free humans up to a point where we can do a lot of more tasks that are more value added, opposed to doing a lot of tasks that we don't add any value at all, that may be perhaps dangerous to us. Mm-hmm.
He's an optimist.
Can you just repeat the you read a quote or you paraphrased a quote about the technology being the ecosystem. So you gave the example of like red dye and
Okay. That's Mr. Postman.
Additive versus ecological.
Additive
versus ecological.
Yeah.
Cool. The water gradually turns pale red.
Yeah.
And how does this all relate to the fact to immigration and the fact that there are so many immigrants and illegal immigrants who are willing to do work that Americans are not willing to do? And in fact, a lot of businesses are completely dependent on their work.
Yeah.
I don't know. Why are you
farms.
Yeah.
Our organic farms, we love our nice vegetables. Yeah. But if the Jamaicans all left, we wouldn't have to be harvesting our veggies right here. Right
yeah. Now. And I think there's
robots.
There's almost two types, right, of immigration, where because I would say in my parents' generation when they were coming up, like almost like right post-colonialism, right? So, well, because England colonized the world and brought their education system and they brought everybody up, it's like, well, wait a second. There's smart people other places, right? So from all over the world, you know, America was like almost open arms. Hey, all the smart people from all over the world come to our country and help build it up, right? So it's like, so in that time, like, for example, my father came over to America on like a full scholarship, right? He took some national exam. He placed first. He comes to America. You know, him and my mom married. So like he gets his college paid for and then he kind of lives his life here. And lots of people in his generation, they took all the high skilled talent and like the really high achievers mm-hmm. from other places in the world. And then America benefits from that type of dynamism mm-hmm. that's coming from different ideas, different way of seeing things, different mm-hmm. attitudes. And so it's like, with immigration, there was a time where, you know, there's actually a big benefit because you're actually taking the best of the ideas from all over the world. You're clustering it in America. You're throwing everybody together and you're kind of seeing what comes out. And at the same time where the low skilled immigration that comes in where people are just actually just looking for a better life. And then sometimes, even in those cases, people that sometimes come illegally, like growing up in D.C., you will meet your taxi driver actually has two PhDs,
yeah.
but he doesn't have any papers and he's driving the taxi. It's not that he's not an educator. That person can actually sit down and build you a financial model from the back of his head. He just can't find a job, right? So that it's like, The issue is really multi-layered. And so it's like, you know, then to the point of, you know, like there's a lot of work that we don't feel like doing that other people will do. And so it's like then, you know, I think that looking at the issue with some, it's just a hard issue, right? Because and then some economists actually are arguing that a part of the lack of American dynamism is that well, you're closing off your borders, and they're almost saying, well, you kind of benefited from bringing in all the smart people from all over the world. And so, like, now, as you close that down, like, what's that going to do to your economy, to your ideas, to your way of life, to your dynamism, as well as America as this, like, land of opportunity for anyone that can? It's like, well, that's not really true anymore if we look at the numbers and actually what's happening and how the society is working. So like the immigration one is not all the immigrants are coming in and like doing the low skill work. There's large, vast swaths of immigrants that like, you know, this person was getting his PhD in like some university in China and he has a great idea and then like MIT writes him a letter, hey, we want to extend your invitation to come and work in our lab for 5 years. And he comes over here and he like does some breakthrough. And so it's like, it's that issue, I don't know, but it's just, there's definitely two sides of it.
Somebody slip ahead. You covered it.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you think, I appreciate just what you're saying about creation, fall, and redemption as being sort of the framework that we have as Christians to think about work and how that enables us to somehow make sense of the fact that you know, work can be terrible, but also we're miserable when we're not working.
Yeah.
Because there's this toil aspect, but it actually was good. How can an awareness of that work was designed to be good, essentially,
and yeah.
of course what we were made for, one of the things we were made for, help someone in a really menial, repetitive, obnoxious job. I mean, which maybe needs to be done.
Yeah.
And like you said, I like what you were saying earlier about trying to think in a macro way, like to basically think about your work theologically. You
know, yeah,
like
yeah, this, yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, some jobs it's easier to do that than others, obviously.
Yeah, I totally agree.
You know, work is good. Work was perfect, you know, but now there's toil. But how do I actually say I'm a Christian doing something that is pretty either grueling or repetitive.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I
for me, the way I try to approach it or even think about it, because even, I mean, there's some part of every job that's grueling, repetitive, and like over the summertime when I just started my job, it's like they wanted me to go through like 1,000 lines of Excel code to like merge these tasks. And then, you know, I felt bad, but I said, don't we have an intern? Like, what are you guys giving me this to go sit through? Like, are you guys, what, come on, doing this? Like, I felt bad, but it's just like, I'm not going to say that. Come on. It's going to take like 3 days to sit through all this thing and be like, there's no way. But, I definitely think like the macro view is helpful. And then a lot of times people say that they want to view work as service, but we don't really mean it, right? So in what ways are you serving people? But then I also try to, because work becomes your identity, a lot of times people, when they're doing that, they feel bad about themselves because they feel like their talents or their skills or whatever they have to offer isn't really fully being used. So I try to almost have them think about, you need to do this, and it's actually creating some good disciplines and skills in you that you can kind of stick it out, that you can be faithful, that you could, you know, there's, you know, other ways that it's actually helping your character and it's building your character up. But then I try to like bring out from them, like, is there something else you want to do? Like, and then so it's like, and can you find some healthy balance of doing both and like building that into your lifestyle, right? So maybe it's like, well, I always wanted to like learn the piano or something like that, or I want to like, you know, build this type of business, or I want to go and do this type of organization. So it's almost, you know, there are multiple things I feel like you can do depending on like the motivation for your work, and you can kind of fulfill your passions and in multiple ways. That's kind of sometimes how I try to approach it.
Justin. I'm just going to jump on that and say, I think as someone who's been employed or had a number of jobs that I would consider toil, the fact that I could actually classify them as toil and this kind of internal dissonance and frustration that I felt about the work was like legitimate, because like this actually is more toil than it is a service or kind of filling, you know, however you want to think about it. But the fact that there's a category of toil that exists means there's some work that's not toil and gives dignity and causes human flourishing. To know that, I mean, it's not always right there. And, sometimes I've had jobs that are toil for much longer than I wanted to. And lots of people live their whole lives just in toil. Yeah. But at least it's saying, you know, that dissonance you're feeling, that dissatisfaction you're feeling is real, because there's more to life than just, like, toil. And
you're made for something.
Yeah, that's a real thing you're feeling. And that's so much, at least for me, that was so much more helpful than, oh, you'll use this as a great example someday to, like, tell someone, you know.
Or all work just sucks, man.
I think even just those categories, of saying that work is just is the experience, your felt experience of work is toil. As someone who's done some toiling labor, I found that just helpful in some ways, too.
Yeah, I remember some books of things Udo Milliman used to teach, which was quite helpful. Just looking at, especially if your job, you know, your identity is your job, your job defines your identity, and if your job is something that is does not lift you up and honor you, but rather drags you down, you don't want to tell anyone what your job is. And you do it just to put food on the table or whatever,
and you think in terms of any expression of your humanness is in leisure time. But that's an attitude that can be really, you've got to look for chinks in that. especially for something repetitive or something in work, which is, because I think that's, and I think he's right. He says, we are created. We are made in God's image. And even repetitive tasks or demeaning tasks, we can set about looking for, what can I do in this, even in this miserable job? Where can I look for places where I can bring light into it? Mm-hmm. Rather than, and it was express my imageness of God even in this, to look for ways in which I can live it out, so that my whole expression of my humanness isn't in my leisure time, but actually is in the work, even though it's demeaning. And I'm not sure that's an adequate answer for Charlie Chaplin in his, you know, Modern Times film, you know, which on the assembly line.
Yeah.
But there's something to that, because we can get a hold of, there's a whole sort of weighting of life that I live for the weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and the rest of it is just sheer boredom, and it's all just trash. And that can become that if we're not careful.
Yeah,
it can become that unnecessarily.
Yeah,
or more than it needs to. Anyway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Just one last miscellaneous odd fact. I remember reading an article when I was doing work on particularly children and their work and that sort of history, but I came across an article on, it was a survey, and I can't remember how many years ago, it was quite a few years ago, on job satisfaction, what jobs people were most satisfied with. And it's so weird, because the job that was highest on job satisfaction was a pre-industrial job. It was blacksmiths. Who recorded being more satisfied with their work than anybody else. And what's interesting is that what they said about it was that it was, they worked for themselves, they could organize their own time, and their job was something they took from start to finish. So again, instead of doing a little automated working for a Ford Motor Company and your job is just put this cog in this thing, it was from start to finish. You know, you forge the horseshoe and you fit it to the horse and everything. But I thought, oh man, there's got to be some equivalents today, because not very many people can be blacksmiths. But it was just interesting the elements in what that study said that had to do with the satisfaction of the person.
It also, you have to use your head, you have to know a lot of stuff,
yeah.
And you use your hands.
If you're using your hands,
yeah.
As well.
So it's both.
Your head and your hands together.
Yeah, that's real.
Mm-hmm. I know a couple of people who are musical instrument makers, making guitars from scratch,
right,
out of pieces of wood.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very much the same kind of thing.
Yeah, they love what they do.
And you come up with this beautiful thing that you have made. Oh, I would love to do that.
Yeah.
Joshua, I just like remark to something you said. I know I've toiled, and for me it is a huge difference in toiling for my own self-employment or toiling for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely that's a really big difference.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm just toiling for myself, it's very different. I lack the dissatisfaction when it happens once in a while to be toiled for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, while people said things like not being able to see, you know, how they fit into the whole process of whatever they were toiling for, and you know, just the way that we categorize the work that we do. And it made me wonder, what does it say about us when we're not content with the small part that we play in a big picture? Because at the end of the day, we are all just small, small, small parts of a very big picture that we don't have the capacity to fathom the fullness of. And so do we not have like a right-sized perspective of self-awareness? Do we not have enough humility to just know our roles and play them? Like when I hear things about people being empowered because they're creators, I can identify with that in one sense as a musician, but also it almost makes me wonder, like, do we have a God complex in that regard? Like, are you satisfied? You're set, like the blacksmith example,
yeah,
right? Like, to see something from start to finish, to dictate your own time and the way that you organize it, and, mm-hmm, you know, to have just so much authority over oneself, mm-hmm, is luxurious, right? But what does that really say? Are we taking, you know, the imageness of God to another level that's, yeah, not healthy? Those are just the thoughts that you guys prompted for me in your comments. I'm so done with you.
Something about what Volvo did in just in that regard, in terms of the construction of a car. I don't know if they still do it, but for a while they were keying onto exactly what you said. That human beings work much better if they can see something completed, rather than being tight one nut and the car goes off and you never see it again. They'd have a whole mess of people who were responsible for building a car in one place. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so they'd have a sense of the wholeness of it, rather than just an irrelevant sort of twist and a wrench on it.
Yeah.
Do you know if they still do that?
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Saturn is doing that.
Well, Marvel was before that.
Oh, wow.
So Saturn didn't make it.
And even
Marvel used to say that way back, not just in all recent few years ago. Yeah. This was
20 years or something ago. Yeah. And then it's even to that point, I know at work a lot of times when you're designing something, they're trying to have you, like the term around work is, we want you to own it from cradle to grave, meaning like, we want you to like be with it when you're at your desk. It's an idea, you're designing it, you know, and you reviewed it, da 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 da. Then it's like, okay, well, when it's getting manufactured, we want you to be with it as it's getting manufactured. And then when it goes and gets used in the engine, we want you to kind of see it, take it off, look at it. And it's almost like, you know, to that point, they're trying to.
Does that happen?
Well, it's happening now, right? It's happening more now. I mean, it happened for me too. It wasn't as mystical for me. I mean, I didn't really care that much, but, personally, but, you know, I mean, it was nice. It was cool at the time, but it was, you know, it wasn't like a, oh, ooh, look, but, I mean.
It wasn't a religious experience.
No, not even a little bit. Not even a little bit, you know.
Talk about calling vocation. I think one of the things that's been really helpful to me in understanding a biblical idea of vocation, which the Puritans had, kind of outlined in a helpful way, is that your vocation is the whole shape of your life calling. Mm. It's not just your job. It's not, you know, what we think about vocational training is the job, but it's the whole shape of your calling. And you may, so if it involves what you do to earn a living to put food on the table, but it also involves what you do in your spare time. It involves your community life. It involves your neighborliness. It involves your family life, and as well as, you know, hobbies you have that you may really be interested in, or service projects. And so, I mean, in this world, which is such a mix of good creational things and fallen, broken things, we may not have a paying job that is terribly fulfilling to us, but it still is. If it's paying for food on the table, if it's paying up, it's a good thing. It's still good. It has dignity. But we may get more satisfaction from all sorts of other things we do that we're not paid for. And that's all part of our vocation. And it also can change through the human life cycle, the balance of what we're doing, what we're getting, how the whole sort of fits together. But I have found that helpful to think of when, you know, and when I was raising kids and I tend to be goal-oriented, and part of my education was, you know, make a list and get these things done, and I make a list and get nothing done. Except, as Dick would remind me, yes, you did. You fed three children, and you, you know, and you fed me, and you, all the things that just had to be done. But that to see it, the whole shape is your vocation, not that, oh, I'm wasting time doing these things so that I can do something more, because I want to do something more important, but actually the whole thing is your calling before God, and it all has dignity.
Yeah.
And some of it's going to be more satisfying than others, but it really helps to tell yourself this, you know, remind yourself, this has dignity, this is valuable, this counts.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about your comment, and when you said the idea of, like, having the God complex, the same old thing. I was just thinking, I mean, it's the story of the fall. I mean, it's Genesis. It's of, I want to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I want to be like God, you know, and Satan saying to Eve, not in so many words, but essentially the question of Eve is that you're not enough as you are. You could have more.
Yeah.
And so I think in some ways, I like the way you described it, but that's what it made me think of. So I think in some ways, that is just part of our struggle. It's part of the mark of the fallenness, is that we do want to be God. We want to be like God. And I think some of the technology makes us feel like we're a bit closer to that.
Yeah, it's like we, like companies are working to feed that ego more, right? And so I've been curious to know, like, what it would look like if companies worked to help us be content with our part,
Good luck.
Advertisers wouldn't like that.
Yeah.
But it actually would be cheaper for them.
Yeah.
If you think about it, right? Yeah. If a guy were content to just twist the wrench around the screw, right? That's a lot less expensive in terms of wages, you know, than a guy who can also, you know, do everything else it takes to build a car and not even pretend to know how. So, I don't know, it's just very, very curious to me in that regard.
One distinction to think about maybe is between dominion, which is a good creational thing, where we're human beings are supposed to be creative and affect the world around us, actually do things that are in some sense like God, but not in a way that oversteps that boundary, but then as opposed to autonomy, basically, where I need to define my own law, essentially. I think one thing I was curious about is the whole model we were talking about in terms of workers assembling a whole car as opposed to just tightening their one bolt, whatever. Was that embraced because it's better for workers? Or was there some benefit for the company itself? Like, I guess the term that comes to mind is like a sense of ownership.
Yeah.
Which would be good for morale, presumably, and maybe even efficiency. Who knows?
Yeah.
If somebody actually like. Yeah, I make cars. I don't just tighten the bolt.
Sure.
So I you sort of see the end result.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was both.
Yeah.
Because you've got happy workers who are happy in their work, you're going to have better cars.
Right.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
But
probably less turnover in the workforce.
Yeah,
more
innovation.
More longevity.
Yeah.
The distinction you make ever is tricky. The way images of God, we're not going to try to be God.
Yeah.
We're not going to set ourselves up as rivals of God. We're going to image God in what we do. So it's a very
to image God. It's both an honor and a cause for humility, right?
Yeah. Like,
otherwise,
yeah. And then on a somewhat a little bit different topic, for the thing that keeps hitting me with even looking at all the technology change is that as technology advances, some of the like deeper human problems are left untouched.
Uh-huh.
Right? It's like, well, are you going to create technology to like feed the homeless? Like, we still have homeless people on our streets. I mean, like, are you going to create technology to, like, make people unbored? It's kind of, I think there's a lecture in the library that says still bored in a culture of entertainment. It's like, I mean, people are still lonely, bored, and, like, some of the really serious problems of, like, what it means to be human and kind of figure it out. It's like, technology is also not solving the sin problem. Are you going to, like, you know, help people, you know, like, be better humans? Sometimes it's like taking the low-hanging fruit, but it's not necessarily solving some of the big problems. Like, something that even sometimes people just say as a joke. It's like, I mean, we're not telling you to solve world hunger, but it's like, well, it's like, that's like, what do we mean? Are we going to do something about these things? Technology is not really pushing us to solve, like, some of the... Technology isn't solving racism. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. We got problems in the world.
Tying with that, and it's tied up with what the woman said about the aristocracy, the idea of the aristocracy. When you were telling the story about getting your car and your phone just telling you, like, oh, you're driving to work, yeah. Or, like, knowing that you're going to Starbucks, what I thought of when you said that was, like, the old idea of, like, a butler, or I was... What's the character's name in the Batman movies? You know, the
Alfred.
Or Alfred in the Batman movies. You know, where it's like somebody who just knows that it's time for your 10:30 coffee.
Yeah.
Coffee, right? Or you know, your bath is warm to just the right temperature, just the right time.
Yeah.
Like, that's what it made me think of, is like a virtual butler. Well, I was
going to
say, your phone's not delivering you coffee, but it
could,
actually.
Yeah, no, it could.
Yes.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking about with that is that there's also, and I think this is where social media comes into play and all these things, but there's this sense of being known.
Sure.
There's this sense of intimacy and being known and being seen.
Yeah.
But it's this crazy cycle, right? Because it's like, we're so much lonelier and we're so much more isolated we're so much more unknown, and social media somehow makes us less seen and less visible, even though we're so visible. And so just to your point of, like, it's not solving all these other issues. There are these core issues of these, like, deep, deep human longings to be seen and known and heard and connected, that the Christian faith has a lot to say about that. God has so much to say, but where technology is sort of like, it's just sort of scratching that itch, but it's not really, and it's sort of creating a bigger chasm.
Yeah.
In a way, too.
Yeah. And it's almost like the same problems we had in the 20th century are the ones we're still facing in the 21st century. I mean, they're like really big human problems that technologies.
We can give false and apparent solutions to deep human problems. I mean, think of how much human need is apparently satisfied by intelligent set. But it's substitutes for the voice. Intelligence set goes all day long. They want a voice happening in the house. And I'm not saying maybe it's some good, but it's certainly bad as a substitute.
So it's cool.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you. Is there a number three, the future work?
I think that's that.